People used to think of the speed of sound as a kind of physical barrier, a brick wall that just couldn't be approached by humans without catastrophic consequences. But then, in 1947, Chuck Yeager, flying the Bell X-1, broke the sound barrier.
You know, ignorance. People really just didn't know. It was ignorance. They thought an airplane would never go faster than sound because of the shock waves that built up on it. But that really didn't make any difference to me. I could care less. It's your job to try it. It's duty. It's just like flying combat. You know, you go on a combat mission, somebody's going to get killed. You just hope it isn't you, but if it is, that's the way it goes. The same way with flying the X-1, it didn't make any difference to me whether I thought the airplane would go faster than sound. I was assigned as a test pilot on it, and it was my duty to fly.
Chuck Yeager's death-defying feat transformed aviation and ushered in the era of modern spaceflight. Yeager turns 96 years old in a few weeks, and we celebrate his birthday with this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the audio vault of the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
The writer Tom Wolfe, in his book The Right Stuff, described Chuck Yeager as the most righteous of all the possessors of the right stuff. Before we hear more from Yeager himself, I want to play you a story Tom Wolfe told about Yeager at an Academy of Achievement event. It's a long story, but wait for the punchline, because it goes to the heart of Chuck Yeager's place in history.
When I was doing a book on the astronauts, just as a matter of reporting, I went out to Edwards Air Force Base out in the desert of California. And they happened to let me up into the control tower, and nothing special is going on until suddenly a voice comes in and says, Edwards Tower, this is 9095, altitude 2,134 feet, coming in 241 knots. A little smoke here in the cockpit obstructing that nice view of Mount Baldy that I was counting on. Well, me, there's almost panic in the control tower because, for a start, if he's going 241 knots, the stall out is 220 in this particular jet aircraft. It has rocket-assisted, actually. And if he stalls in that plane, you're going to drop like a set of car keys. That's going to be the glide capability of that airplane at 230 knots. The guy in the control tower even gets a little nervous in his voice. He says, Air Force 9095, this is Edwards Tower. Are you declaring an emergency? Are you declaring? He says, nope, not declaring an emergency. Just want to get permission to put her down on Rogers Dry Lake. That's this long, very flat, forgiving lake that tests airplanes land on. And the tower is urging him to, you know, eject or just get out of this situation. Finally, this voice says, repeat, Edwards Tower, I'm not declaring an emergency. I'm just trying to get permission to land on Rogers Dry Lake, you pug knockers. And here's this drawling, wonderful drawling voice. So after, I said, who is this guy? Who's in this situation? They say, oh, it's that guy from your neck of the woods, Fahey. I had been talking earlier in the day to a guy named Fahey from New York. You don't find many pilots from New York in the Air Force for whatever reason. And this guy had an absolute New York street voice. He was telling me how He was trying to fry some frankfurters for breakfast. Every word he uttered was right off the streets of New York. In New York, you don't say hot dog, you say frankfurter, but you don't say frankfurter either, you say frankfurter. And the stove was electric, and he was talking about electricity. In New York, nobody says C's or T's, it's all D's and S's and so on. I say, it can't be him. And this guy in the control tower says, no, it can be him. He says, once they're up in the air over Edwards Air Force Base, they all use the voice of Chuck Yeager. Now, that was the first time I had heard the name Chuck Yeager. And it suddenly dawned on me there was this hidden pyramid of status in flying. It had nothing to do with your outward rank. There were those who had this right stuff, which eventually became the title of the book, and those who didn't.
Well, before Chuck Yeager made his way to the tippy top of that pyramid, before he became an icon and a cool as a cucumber prototype for generations of pilots, he was a humble child of Appalachia. Here's that voice that so many pilots have tried to emulate.
I was born in Myra, West Virginia, which was just a post office on Mud River very near Hamlin, West Virginia. My first recollection was when we moved to Hamlin when I was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old. And that's where I spent my life until I was 18 years old. And to me, it was a rural town of about 600 population. It's in the middle of the hills. And primarily it was agricultural, timber, coal mine, and some natural gas. And my father was a natural gas driller, and he would go down some 3,000 feet into the ground. And he would, it was an interesting piece of machinery, and I was exposed to machinery at a very young age, and I liked it. I got to overhaul engines and run big gasoline pumps and water pumps and watch him dress bits, heating them until they were red hot, and then resharpening the bits that cut the hole in the ground. It was interesting to me as a kid, but I really wasn't as big as my big brother, who turned out to be about 6'4 and weighed about 240. He could handle 16-pound sledgehammers and carry pipes. I couldn't do that. I was just an average-sized kid.
But a kid with anything but average vision, 20/10 in each eye, 2 times better than normal. When this conversation was recorded in 1991 for the Academy of Achievement, Yeager still had that eyesight at the age of 68. It gave him an edge, naturally, when he became a fighter pilot in World War II. But it came in pretty handy, too, when he was running around the hills of West Virginia playing football and basketball.
And I also played a trombone in a high school band and chased gals, so I was a pretty busy kid. And the subjects that I liked very much in school were mathematics and algebra and typing. I could type 60 words a minute easy. Anything that took hand-eye coordination, I had a good time at it. History, my teachers had trouble passing me, I would say, in English literature and things like that. But just that to me was school.
I wonder if you had any kind of vision of what you wanted to accomplish back then.
No. And actually, you know, when people tell you that, you know, I had my mind made up when I was 2 years old to do this, you know, I think take that with a grain of salt, because it's very difficult for a kid who's going through an educational process and being exposed to the world to decide what he wants to do, because he's really hadn't been exposed to that kind of a life yet. And I had no idea what I wanted to do except exist, and that was about it. So I had no interest in airplanes. We didn't even know what an airplane was. We didn't even see them except flying in the air.
You know, throughout your career, you have shown incredible burning drive to keep besting yourself and besting the world's records. And I wonder if that sense of kind of burning ambition was there when you were a kid. Were you aware of it?
It was taught mainly it's pretty well family discipline. Your father taught you to finish anything you started. And I think that carries throughout your adult life. Most people, I would say, their morality and their personalities are formed when they're rather young. And that characteristic will carry out throughout their lifetime. And that's the way we were disciplined as kids, quite severely. If you if you didn't finish your jobs. And I think that's what brought about a desire to finish what you started, you know, and do the best job you could. And that's probably the reason that characteristic carried throughout my life. So
I think, though, it's one thing to finish a job and you know, have a sense of a job well done, and it's another thing to do it better than anyone else on the face of the earth does it. Was there that kind of striving in anyone?
No, yeah. No, not you know, there's no ultimate goal out there to do something, you know, twice as good as anyone else can, just to do the job the best you can. If it turns out good, fine. If it doesn't, that's the way it goes. So.
But there's no such thing as sort of a half-assed attempt.
No, never has been.
Let's go back to Chuck Yeager's very first close-up encounter with an airplane. It happened, he told Gail Eichenthal, when he was 15 or 16 years old.
As I recall, somebody said that there was a cub or something had made an emergency landing in a cornfield about, I suppose, a mile from the house, so I rode my bicycle up there to look at it. I wasn't impressed because I didn't know what it was. So you just look at it and turn around and leave. So
it wasn't love at first sight?
No. In fact, I had no knowledge of them, so obviously I didn't have any intention to be associated with them.
That association began, though, a few years later when the United States entered World War II. Yeager was in his senior year of high school. He and pretty much all the boys he knew signed up. But what prompted Yeager to choose the Army Air Corps, precursor to the Air Force, when he had absolutely zero interest in planes?
Probably the recruiter was better than the Navy or anyone else. And also, I think there was a guy, one of the guys who went through pilot training about the year that I graduated from high school. He came home. He was a pretty neat guy. And he said it was a fun job, but flying to me, I never associated myself with it. And when I enlisted in the Army, it was just to be a mechanic. There was no intention to be a pilot or anything like that. In fact, when I got in September 1941, I was trained as a mechanic, which was easy. I'd already had so much experience in mechanical things like engines and things that Dad exposed us to all the time that I was just trained and began working on airplanes as a crew chief. I serviced them, overhauled the engines and things like that. And then finally, in sometime around, the latter part of November 1941, I remember reading a notice on the bulletin board that if you were a high school graduate and 18 years of age and could pass a physical, then you could apply for pilot training under the Flying Sergeant program. You wouldn't be a cadet or make lieutenant or be an officer. When you graduated from flying school, you'd be a sergeant pilot. And it looked like a pretty neat deal, and I just did it just to be doing something, so I put in my application. And I recall taking my physical on December the 4th, 1941, and passing it, and then just sweating it out for 6 months. Finally, they called me up for pilot training. But that's, you know, it's just a matter of being at the right place at the right time.
A little more about that timing. Up until the time Chuck Yeager spotted that notice on a bulletin board, the only people who were allowed to train as military pilots were officer cadets who'd finished at least 2 years of college. Yeager only had a high school degree. But as the U.S. geared up to enter World War II, it became apparent that our need for pilots was far greater than the number of men eligible for pilot training. That's why Congress voted to lower the bar, authorizing what was called the Enlisted Pilot Training Program. It allowed high school graduates to apply. Within 2 years, the college requirement was reinstated. So luckily, Chuck Yeager made it in that narrow window with 2,500 other enlisted men. They were originally only supposed to fly cargo planes or reconnaissance missions, but most of them were, in the end, elevated to the rank of flight officer. And a good number ended up flying combat planes. A handful even became fighter aces, like Chuck Yeager, who shot down 13 enemy planes, 5 of them in a single day.
It sounds like your first experience as a pilot was not all that much fun. Can you
describe
it?
My first ride in an airplane wasn't any fun. as I recall, it was the spring of 42, and I was at Victorville and a crew chief on the AT-11, which was a twin-engine bombardier training airplane, and I had overhauled one of the engines, and the engineering officer had to take the airplane up and check it out and asked me if I wanted to go along. And I'd never been in an airplane before, and I said, yeah, I'd like to. So I got in and sat down in the seat and fastened the safety belt, and he took off, and he went over to one of the dry lakes down there, very near Edwards, between Edwards and Victorville, and started shooting touch-and-go landings, and it was rough and turbulent. Pretty soon I got sick and threw up on my airplane, and it was a very uncomfortable situation. So I didn't particularly care for it, but I'd already applied for pilot training, and so I think that's the only time I went up in my airplane until they called me up for pilot training.
And then you still, didn't you still get sick when you were?
First time or two going up, as long as someone else was flying, you know, you got a little woozy. But then when I started flying the airplane myself, all that went away.
Talk about your aggressiveness as a pilot. Was that something that came very quickly?
Well, yes, I learned quickly, obviously. We trained in the United States before we went to England. We trained in P-39, little Bell Air Cobras. And it was all dogfighting, air-to-ground gunnery, dive bombing, skip bombing, buzzing, and, you know, really learning to fly a fighter. We were training to go overseas. And I was no better than the rest of the fighter pilots. I had very good eyes, as a lot of the guys did, and also could dogfight. It's a matter of experience. And then when we went to England in November of 43, and we got the first P-51s in 8th Air Force, it's, as I recall, we picked up a P-51. I'd never been in one before, and flew it from this assembly base down to our base in Leiston. And the next day, we're sitting over the middle of Germany fighting in them. You have to learn real quick. And that's the way our pilots were. And as I recall, on my 7th mission, I shot down a 109, which was my first airplane that I shot down. We were on a raid over Berlin, the first daylight bombing raid over Berlin. And I came home, and I saw a 109, and I nailed him, and to me it was a lot easier than I thought it would be, because, you know, we were a little bit apprehensive about dogfighting the Germans and their fighters, and they had a lot of experience dogfighting and we didn't, and so I nailed the guy. But the next day I got shot down.
That was the next day. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to that March 5th, 1944. Describe exactly what happened.
I was in a dogfight with the 3190s, and I got hit head on with 20 millimeter cannon, and the prop came off the airplane, part of the wing, the canopy, and it caught on fire. So me and the airplane parted company. That's the way it happens. You bail out, you free fall in your parachute, and then when you get down to within 3,000 or 4,000 feet of the ground, you pull the ripcord and the parachute pops, and you land, and that's about the way it happens. I picked up a few wounds. I had a couple of slugs, one in my leg, and I had some, like, 20 millimeter fragments in my hands, and a couple cuts on my head, but they were minor, so it didn't make much difference. Well, when I got shot down and when I landed in my parachute, we were in occupied France, and there were quite a few Germans around. Obviously, you've got to hide, or they'll pick you up. And I got into the woods as deep as I could and hid, and they never caught me, and I hung around or laid out there for a day until things quietened down, and then contacted a French farmer or woodcutter, and I couldn't speak French, but he could see I was an American flyer because I had my flying gear on, leather jacket and flying suit, and he knew that I needed some kind of help, and he went to the right people instead of turning me in and got me with the resistance forcers, the Maquis, who in turn took me and under the wing for the next month, and I worked my way down through France, and finally went through the Pyrenees and went into Spain in a neutral country. So.
Was it a little bit scary to trust this farmer? He could have been German...
No, you don't have any choice. You either do or you don't. That's where you look at it.
You had a 50-50 chance, I guess.
Yeah.
So then what happened when you got to Spain?
Well, I was interned in a town of Lerida, and then the American consulate came up and talked to us and made sure we were an American, and then put us up in a hotel, gave us money, and we just bummed around there for about a month. And finally, during that period of time of May 1944, we were beginning to help Spain, who was running out of gasoline because they didn't have any petroleum products. And we were then begin trading gasoline for American pilots that were in Spain. You know, there was something like 2,600 airmen interned in Spain who either, you know, had made it through the Pyrenees or took their airplanes there and jumped out of them. And the way we got out was that the Spanish took us down to Gibraltar and turned us over to the British on the island of Gibraltar. And then finally the British were, you know, flying airplanes from Gibraltar around the tip of Spain and Portugal up to England, and I bummed a ride up on one of the airplanes and then went back to my squadron. So,
according to military rules at that time, you were supposed to be sent home after having any contact with French resistance.
Well, basically, they didn't want you to compromise the French underground system. And fortunately, I didn't go straight back to my squadron when I got to Spain. I was held in sort of a secure house where you couldn't get out until they interrogated you and make sure you were an American flyer, you know, and they wanted your whole story, where you'd gotten shot down, the outfits that you were with, and then they brought a pilot down from my squadron to identify me and to make sure that I was who I said I was. And then obviously they started publishing orders on me to go back to the United States. And that's when I sort of backed off and said, I don't want to go home. I want to go back to my squadron and fly. And they said, well, you can't because the rules prohibit it. And fortunately, the invasion was just coming along. And when the invasion occurred, the resistance forces surfaced, and General Eisenhower, whom I'd worked my way all the way up to sea, said, okay, go back. So,
you had really had a near miss there, being shot down. Why did you push so hard to fly again after that?
Well, I knew if I came home a flight officer, I'd stay a flight officer the rest of my life. That was my rank, you know, and I only had 8 missions, so I had no reason to come home. The rest of the guys were still at the squadron flying, so.
The word fear didn't enter your mind.
Well, no, that's not part of your career.
That was only Chuck Yeager's first near-death experience. People often talk about getting a second chance in life. Well, Chuck Yeager got a second, then a third, then a fourth, then, well, it's hard to say how many really. When he became a test pilot after the war, there were plenty of brushes with death. Many of his colleagues did die on the job. In that era, aviation technology was quickly evolving, and test pilots were a different brand of brave. Yeager told interviewer Gail Eichenthal how he ended up becoming one.
What happened? That one little thing that I had gotten shot down in March 1944 and evaded capture and went through the Pyrenees into Spain and was interned, when I returned to the United States, they made me a basic instructor in Texas. Then the war ended in Europe, and they freed all of the prisoners of war. Well, the Air Force came out with a policy, or the Army Air Corps back then, that those airmen, both pilots and navigators, bombardiers, and gunners, who had gotten shot down, could select any base in the United States they wanted to. Well, that policy covered me because I'd been shot down and evaded, and was known as an evadee. So evadees and prisoners of war could select any base they wanted. So I looked at the map of my hometown in West Virginia, and Wright Field was the closest air base to my hometown, and I picked Wright Field. And when I reported in to Wright Field in the summer of 1945, the personnel types looked at my record and they saw I was a fighter pilot, but the one thing that caught their eye, I was a maintenance officer, meaning I'd been trained as a crew chief and aviation maintenance. And then when I served in my fighter squadron in combat, I served as a maintenance officer, you know, running the crew chiefs and maintenance guys. And when I got back, they saw this, and there was a vacancy in a fighter test section there in the flight test division that needed a maintenance officer. And they assigned me there. And I, you know, here's the hangars full of every kind of airplane that we were flying. And it was interesting to me because I got to fly every airplane after they were worked on. Then the maintenance officer had to take them up and check all the systems out and then sign them off. And then you turn them over to the test pilot to do their test work in them. And that's how I got to Wright Field. Now, over the next year or 6 months, I put on many air shows and jets all over the United States. and Colonel Boyd, who was the chief of the flight test division, watched a few of those air shows, and he was impressed. And he noticed also that me being a maintenance officer, I never had any trouble with my airplanes. You know, if something happened to them, I could fix them, and I always brought them home. And so that's when he approached me in the spring of, well, actually, it was in December 1945, said, would you like to go to the test pilot school? And I said, well, I only have a high school education, and it might be kind of tough for me, the academic requirement. He said, no, you can make out. And so I went into the test pilot school, and that's what got me started in test programs. And then later, of course, when the X-1 came along in 1947, he selected me for the test program. And the reason he did was that I understood machinery and obviously could fly an airplane.
And he also, I'm sure, saw something in you, in your personality.
Well, I don't know. Personality to him didn't mean a heck of a lot. It's your ability to perform in an airplane. And that caught his eye. And also, he knew that the X-1 was a very dangerous program, and he knew that I could take care of myself. So,
you got married right after the war.
Well, I came home in February and got married. February 26th, I got married, as I recall. I got home about the 1st of February.
I know that your wife was a very important support system for you your whole life. And one of the things that amazes me in reading about your life is how brave she was to let you keep going up there.
Well, I was flying when I met her, obviously. But the point is, being an Air Force wife is not an easy life. And it was tough because you travel around a lot. And there's a high risk factor, obviously, especially so in research flying. And she bowed her back and did it. And it worked out pretty good.
Chuck Yeager's wife looked a lot like actress Vivian Leigh. Her name was Glennis, and she died in 1990, the year before this conversation was recorded. Chuck Yeager considered her his good luck charm. So back in the 1940s, he painted Glamorous Glennis on the side of the X-1. If you go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., you'll have no trouble spotting the plane. The X-1 is bright orange, small and sleek, shaped like a bullet, with a long, pointy stinger on the nose, and just one seat.
You talked about how you came to be chosen for the X-1 program, but what was the point of the aircraft in the first place? What were they hoping to accomplish?
Well, in World War II, in combat, in P-51s, during dogfights with 109s, 190s, for the first time we became exposed to the effects of the speed of sound on our airplanes. And what happened, the airplane diving through the air at the fastest, a Mustang or a P-47 or any of the other fighters that we're using in World War II, the fastest it would go is about 80% of the speed of sound. But going through the air at 80% of the speed of sound, they had very thick wings and canopies, and that additional distance that the air had to travel to go around that wing that's going through it at about 80% of the speed of sound, that additional distance that air had to move to go around it brought its relative velocity to the skin of the wing up to the speed of sound. And when this happened, a shock wave formed on the thickest part of the wings and the canopy, and behind these shock waves were turbulent air, and your airplane would shake and buffet. And it wasn't a hazard, it was just a nuisance if you were trying to track some guy at high speed. So we knew a problem existed because of the relationship of the speed of sound of the airplane. So in 1944, the Air Force, or then Army Air Corps, led a contract with Bell Aircraft Company to build a little research rocket that would fly in the region of the speed of sound or faster to find out what was causing this buffeting phenomena or compressibility. Fortunately, we knew that we had a so-called sound barrier there that we had to solve the problem or we would never go any faster than we were doing at that time. And that's the reason the X-1 was made, was to solve those problems or at least find out what was causing the compressibility or buffeting on the airplanes.
How was the X-1 built to try and overcome that?
Well, number one, they built the airplane with very thin wings so that the airplane could go faster before it ran into the buffeting problem. It was rocket powered, which meant that you had full thrust at altitude, which jet engines, decrease in thrust the higher you go. and is also built about 2.5 times stronger than airplanes that we were flying at that time. The airplanes we used in World War II and the ones that were built immediately after World War II were stressed for 7.33 Gs, or 7.33 times the pull of gravity. And if you overstressed them, they would break. Obviously, the wings would break off and the like. But the X-1 was stressed for 18 Gs, positive or negative. And so it would stay together in case you run into a problem. And also, it had a movable horizontal stabilizer. The tailplane on all airplanes just stabilizes, and you have elevators on the back to make the airplane go up and down. Well, they did build the capability in the X-1 to move the whole horizontal stabilizer, change angle of attack. And that really was the big secret on how we got the airplane through the speed of sound, that horizontal stabilizer.
If you had any trouble following that bit of aerodynamic talk, I'm with you. To make sure I understood, I went and consulted a diagram of a plane and did a little extra reading up. So let me try and rephrase. Picture a passenger jet. You know those little wings at the back of the plane that are part of the tail? They are there to keep the plane level as it flies. They're called the horizontal stabilizers, and they're in a fixed position. But each one has a movable flap, similar to the flap you see on the main wings. And those are the elevators Jaeger just referred to. A pilot is able to control the elevators from the cockpit to tilt the nose of the plane toward the sky or toward the ground. The thing is, though, when Chuck Jaeger took the X-1 out the first several times, the elevators stopped doing their job as soon as the plane got within 6% of the speed of sound. And no one wants to be in a plane that points up, or especially down, without control. So the engineers invented a mechanism that made the whole horizontal tailpiece adjustable, not just the elevators. It involved compressed nitrogen and a jack screw air motor, whatever that is, but voila, problem fixed. 2 or 3 more practice flights, and Jaeger was able to steer the plane safely through Mach 1, otherwise known as the speed of sound.
And that was the big thing that came out of the whole X-1 program, was finding out that you needed a horizontal stabilizer to operate in the region of the speed of sound or above the speed of sound. And that's the reason on every fighter that you see today, you just see a slab tail back there and no elevators.
Of course, the other big thing that came out of breaking the sound barrier was discovering it wasn't a barrier. When the X-1 hit that sweet speed, all the shock waves and the shaking stopped. It was like racing your car down a highway filled with potholes and speed bumps, and then hitting a patch of newly paved, utterly flat asphalt. But by the way, on Chuck Yeager's big supersonic day in 1947, everything was not smooth sailing before he stepped into the plane. Every great story needs a suspenseful glitch, and here's his.
The X-1 was, to me, sort of fly twice a week airplane. It took 2 or 3 days to reduce the data from your flight. It was a complex airplane to get serviced with liquid oxygen, alcohol, and gaseous nitrogen. And in the meantime, I'm flying about 15 different other airplanes every day on different test programs. So it was a hard grind. The X-1 was to me, was a pleasure to fly because, you know, you weren't crammed or really crowded in doing test work. And you took the whole day to do it. And it just so happens that particular flight, I think, was on a Tuesday. On the weekends there at Muroc, it was called then, we used to go out to Pancho Barnes, she had a rodeo grounds and a swimming pool and motel and a good restaurant. Go out there and unwind. And I took Glennis out there, I think, on a Saturday night. And we loved to ride horses. So we went out after dinner and were riding horses and chasing each other. And coming back, somebody closed the gate and it was dark and I didn't see it. So my horse hit the fence and flipped me and I broke a couple of ribs. And that was on a Saturday night. Sunday, I moped around, and then Monday, I had to go into the base, and I went to a local doctor there, and he said, we've got two busted ribs. I'll tape you up, and And it really didn't make that much difference in flying the airplane because it's not strenuous other than handling it with your hands and feet on the rudder pedals and the control surfaces and loading pressure domes and turning switches on, things like that. So my only problem was it was painful to get into the airplane because you had to come down a ladder and go through a little hole on the right side. But then the hard part was closing the door once old Jack Ridley came down the ladder and held the door against the right side. Had a lever. It was really tough to, and it took both hands all you could do. And I couldn't handle it with my right side because handle. So he made me about a 10-inch long broomstick that I could stick in the end of the door handle, give me that mechanical advantage. And that's the way we solved the problem. So, but it really didn't make much difference.
Did your superiors realize what was going on? We didn't have superiors,
so-called. We were working test pilots at Muroc, and our boss, Colonel Boyd, was at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. We were pretty well on our own. And that's the way it was done in the old days. There was no big complex, you know, PR types and cameras and stuff like that. It was just a job, and that's exactly what we were doing.
You've described that flight in some ways as anticlimactic, maybe because it was unusually smooth.
Well, it really, and yet that when I commented a minute ago about the X-1 was fun to fly, that's the way we looked at it, because very interesting. See, you're doing research flying. You're doing things and solving problems that no one else has ever been able to solve. So it was interesting to see all these things come along, running out of elevator. I was new, you know, all the engineers said, Jesus, what's going on, you know? And then flying with the flying tail, that was something new. And actually, you really don't think about the outcome of any kind of a flight, whether it's combat or any other kinds of flights, because you really have no control over it. And that's the way I looked at the X-1. You don't worry about the outcome, obviously. You concentrate on what you're doing to do the best job you can to stay out of a serious situation. And that's the way the X-1 was. When we got it above Mach 1 without it flying apart, you know, you can laughingly say now, well, I was disappointed because it didn't blow up, but that's not true. You're a little bit surprised that things didn't fly apart because it's the way you've been sort of thinking. But when it didn't, you're relieved.
You weren't initially planning a breakthrough that day.
It's not a matter of planning. We didn't know. Number one, we didn't even know that we would ever break Mach 1. And as far as knowing when, we had no idea when because we didn't know what was going on. And it just worked out that way.
I gather that the descent that day was tricky.
All of the landings in the X-1 were tricky. It was a liquid rocket-powered airplane. You sat against a liquid oxygen tank about 290 below zero. It was cold. You had a lot of windshield frosting sometimes, especially when your breath condensed on the windshield. Of course, you had an oxygen mask on. You were in a 100% nitrogen gas atmosphere. I mean, that's the reason we used Rogers Dry Lake there at Muroc, now Edwards Air Force Base, that the shuttle lands on, because it was an easy lake to land on. And the X-1 was tricky to land because it landed so fast, you know, but pushing 200 miles an hour. And all your landings were dead stick, meaning you flew it until you exhausted all of your liquid oxygen and alcohol, so you were a glider, but a very fast glider.
Takeoffs were a good bit easier because actually the X-1 wasn't built to take off at all. To save fuel, it had to be hauled along in the belly of a B-29, like a bomb, and then released in midair, already at an altitude of somewhere around 25,000 feet.
Can you tell us what it's like when you're just about to be dropped from a B-29, what you're feeling?
You don't feel anything. You're too busy. You're going through your checklist, you know, loading the pressure regulators, the domes, and checking all the instrumentation. And that's about the way of it. And you listen to the B-29 crew who's hauling you up, and he'll start diving to pick up speed so that he drops you out at a speed above your stall speed, which the stalling speed on the X-1 fully loaded was 240 miles an hour indicated, which is pretty fast. And you're heavy, and it's a compact little airplane, and you come out of a dark place into bright sunlight, you know, for a second you're kind of blinded, but it didn't take you long for your pupils to shrink down. And that's, you really don't give much thought to the drop. You're too busy.
Yeager went on to break other records for speed and for altitude, and he survived quite a few more harrowing mechanical failures that could have cost him his life, but didn't. Like in 1953, when he flew 2.5 times the speed of sound, but went into a dangerous spin that broke open the clear enclosure over the cockpit, causing a precipitous drop in pressure. How he got out of that one seems like a miracle, but he says that understanding the plane's systems was always the key to his survival. It allowed him to analyze and problem solve, even in the midst of catastrophe, even semi-conscious. Chuck Yeager was nothing if not the king of cool under pressure. It's no wonder, then, that after the Soviets launched Sputnik in 1957 and the Americans climbed aboard the space race, it was Chuck Yeager who the military chose to run the training of the Mercury 7, the very first generation of astronauts. Yeager didn't qualify to be an astronaut himself because he didn't have a college degree. It's a story that's told in Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, and in the movie version, starring Sam Shepard as Yeager.
Well, these must be our gentlemen from Washington, scouting for astronauts.
Scouting for lab rabbits, more like.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get what you said.
What I said was lab rabbits.
What's that supposed to mean?
Well, that just means that you boys don't need no honest-to-God pilots. You know, what you ought to get is a little old lab rabbit to curl up inside your damn capsule. You know, with his heart going pitter-patter. And wire up the kazoo. I don't hold with it.
That's Yeager?
Yeah. I'll tell you what else. Anybody goes up in that damn thing is going to be spam in a can.
I'll drink to that.
Chuck Yeager said pretty much the same thing in real life during this conversation with the Academy of Achievement.
I gather that the idea of shooting off in a space capsule was not all that attractive a proposition.
Well, I only had a high school education. I didn't give it a thought. And I could care less about it, because to me it wasn't flying. It was just riding in on something that you had no control over. And I didn't, number one, I wasn't eligible. Number two, I could care less. It was interesting. I'm sure the view was pretty, but that's about the only thing you say for it. I didn't pay an awful lot of attention to the whole space program until 1960. Well, I went through the War College and was promoted to full colonel. And when I got out of the War College, they assigned me back to Edwards Air Force Base and put me in charge of then the test pilot school. And when I moved into the test pilot school, there were a couple programs coming within the Air Force, the X-20 Dinosaur program and the MOLE program, Manned Orbital Laboratory. And both of those were space weapon systems. And the Air Force was very much involved in space. In fact, it was responsible for space. NACA, you know, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, was basically, that's what it said, it was aeronautics. When we started, I took over the school. What I did was we started a space course in the test pilot school. We changed the name of the school to the Aerospace Research Pilot School. And we started training guys for potential astronaut duty. And those astronauts were selected for the Manned Orbital Laboratory and the X-20 Dinosaur. The X-20 Dinosaur was very similar to the space shuttle, except it's only probably 1/3 as large. It was strapped on a Titan 3C liquid rocket with 2 strap-on solid boosters, just like the shuttle. And it would go into orbit and then re-enter and land the same way the shuttle does. Instead of a wheels, it had skids to land on them like the X-2 had. And we trained, in fact, we bought a whole space mission simulator for something like $6 million. We had it set up in the school and we could give simulation on a whole space mission, including rendezvous and docking in space. We had the astronauts training in the MOLE program and the X-20 program was going along. And finally, in 1960, late 65, 66, the administration made a decision that space would be for peaceful purposes. and they canceled the X-20 and the Manned Orbital Laboratory, and then formed NASA, National Space Administration. And when this happened, the Soviet military moved right into the void in developing space weapon systems. Then NASA got started in reusable space systems for peaceful purposes. And we canceled then the X-20 and the MOLE program, and we did away with our whole space mission simulator and went right back to test pilot training at the school, and I left and went to Vietnam.
You could probably hear a little resentment in Chuck Yeager's voice there. He had made significant contributions to manned spaceflight, training nearly half of the astronauts who served in the Gemini, Mercury, and Apollo programs. And he thought the government's decision to change the course of the space program was misguided. During this interview, decades later, he regarded NASA as a bloated civil service bureaucracy. In Vietnam, Yeager commanded the 405th Fighter Wing out of the Philippines, training bomber pilots and flying combat missions. His service earned him a promotion to Brigadier General, and he remains one of the very few to rise from an enlisted man to a general in the Air Force. I want to end with two great yarns Yeager told, though, about what he loved best, being in planes, even when they nearly cost him his life. Both stories took place in the 1960s during his days training astronauts at Edwards Air Force Base. The first involves a misbegotten flight with astronaut Neil Armstrong, who insisted he could land the plane they were in on a dry lake bed that Yeager insisted wasn't dry enough.
If the dry lakes are wet, obviously, you can't land safely an airplane that comes in at, you know, a couple hundred miles an hour. You can tear off the gear or skids and end up tumbling. And I went over to NASA, and they had a T-33, and Neil was flying it, so I took my chute over and my helmet, and we had just wore a light flying suit and gloves, and I got in the back seat and sat there, and Neil taxis out and takes off on the dry lake bed, and we fly up to Smith's Ranch Lake, and he backs off, comes in, he's going to touch down. I said, "Neil, you know, there the lake is wet." And he said, "No, I think it looks dry enough for me to just touch down and let it roll, and I'll add power and then come back off." And I said, "Hey, you get on that lake surface in a T-33 and it starts sinking in, you're never going to overcome the drag with the power up here at about 5,000 feet elevation where the lake bed is." And that's exactly what happened. He came in, touched down, man, the airplane starts slowing down. He puts full power on it, and it keeps slowing down. Finally, it just stops and sinks in the mud. And we're sitting there, you know, shut it off. And I said, "You know, now what?" We're 30 miles from the road, and it's about 3:30 in the afternoon, and it's cold. You got 30 miles to walk with thin flying suit on. And fortunately, Paul Bickle sent a Goonie Bird, a C-47 at NASA down there, up to follow us, because he suspected something might happen. He just good insurance. And we sat there for about a half an hour, and, you know, and just sitting on the wing of the airplane, and you could walk on this, the lake bed, leave footprints. But pretty soon the old Goonie Bird hove into sight. So I got back in the airplane, got the battery switch on, turned the radio on, and told the guy, said, "Hey, you know, we only got one choice. If you land over next to the edge of the lake and keep the airplane rolling, you probably won't sink, and then we can get back off the ground." I said, "Give us time to walk over to the edge of the lake, and don't slow the airplane down. You just keep the door open. We'll jump aboard." And he did. He landed and slowed it down again. He was leaving a pretty good rut in the lake, but he kept power on. As he came by, we ran along and jumped in the back end of the airplane, and we got on back to Edwards. It was after dark, and the T-33 set up there, and the Navy went out and recovered it, I don't know, a week later. It was just an experience that, you know things because you live on those lake beds like I had since 1945. And guys, you know, they don't use their head.
It's not the most flattering picture of the man that walked on the moon.
Well, Neil was a pretty good engineer. He wasn't too good an airplane driver.
And Yeager's other story, the one I want to end on, is about the time he came closest to death. Because even if you can't quite follow the technical twists and turns of what went wrong, just hearing Chuck Yeager describe the procedures he calmly took to save himself is a marvel. He was flying a Lockheed F-104A Starfighter, which can go twice the speed of sound. But it had been modified with a hydrogen peroxide rocket engine in the tail, extra thrusters and other things to better simulate a space rocket for the trainees. It could get up to 118,000 feet. That's more than three times normal cruising altitude in a passenger jet. Yeager flew it 40 times. He knew it well, but it was touchy to handle with a lot of potential for error.
What happened on this flight was that when the airplane came into the atmosphere at about a 50-degree angle of attack, and I couldn't get the nose down, the airplane pitched up and went into a flat spin. And what you realize now is the airplane's in a flat spin, and the engine RPM, because there's no air going through the intake ducts, the engine stops. And when that stopped, you're in a no-win situation. That's exactly what it is. You sit there and said, but you have one other alternative, that's eject. Well, I also had a drag chute on the airplane that we used for landing. And when I went through, the airplane was in a very flat, slow spin, and I had my pressure suit on, it was inflated. And I was sat there and watching, and I was talking to Bud Anderson, who was chasing me in a T-33. He was down, way down low, looking at me coming. And I was talking to the space position branch, the guys were recording data, and said, I got a real problem. There's just no way of getting this thing out of a spin. And so, as I went through 30,000 feet, I deployed the drag chute, which you normally deploy for landing. Well, when I did, the drag chute comes out and it popped the nose down on the airplane. But there's a link that the drag chute's hooked to the airplane with that designed a shear at 180 miles an hour. And that's in case the drag chute comes out accidentally while you're flying. It won't stop the airplane. Well, it just so happened when a nose went down, you know, as I went through 180 miles an hour, the drag chute sheared and the parachute released and the airplane pitched back flat because there's, you know, 180 mile an hour going through the intake duct's not gonna give you engine RPM. It takes about 300 mile an hour. When this happened, the airplane flipped back flat and I don't think it turned, it just fell at 100 miles an hour. Now you've got the egress systems. You know them intimately, and it pays off because a lot of times you have to use them in a semi-conscious state. And I knew my rocket seat that I was riding. I knew its capability, so I wrote it down to about 6,000 feet, which is not low, and went ahead and ejected. Well, the rocket seat blows you out of the airplane and gives you about 100 mile an hour velocity away from the airplane. Well, it just so happened that the airplane is falling at about 100 miles an hour. So when I used the seat, the airplane just fell away from the seat, obviously. The seat sat there, and then 2 seconds after you leave the airplane, the lap belt blows open on the seat, which is what holds you in the seat. You've got leg restrainers, cables that hold your heels into the seat for flailing when you come out at high speed, and you know, a lot of things happen. I sat and watched the seat go through a sequencing, you know, knowing when it was going to happen. And finally, the lap belt popped open, and there's a butt kicker that kicks you out of the seat. I felt that go, and also my cable cutters cut my leg restrainer cables, and so I fell through. When this happened, then your F5 release on your parachute is armed. And as you fall through 14,000 feet, the chute will open. Well, I was below 14,000 feet, obviously, so the chute opened the minute that the F5 release said to open, and it did. But the problem was I didn't have enough velocity through the air. See, I was just starting to fall again to pull that quarter bag, which is on the canopy of your parachute. Well, that little pilot chute on that quarter bag needs about 60 mile an hour to pull it off the quarter bag. And this is, you know, I don't know anything like this is going on. All I know is that I'm free fire. My chute has released, but I haven't got a canopy slowing me down. I can feel flopping in the breeze. Well, by the time, at about this time, the seat, you know, which kicked me out up here, it also is falling, and it became entangled in the shroud lines of the parachute. I don't know this either, but this is the way it happened. And when finally I picked up enough speed, 60 or 70 miles an hour falling, with the canopy up there following, that quarterbag came off, the canopy popped, and when it popped, the damn seat that's entangled in the shroud lines, I'm falling about like this, and it flopped me up like this. Well, the seat hit me in the face piece of my pressure suit, and what hit me was the rocket, the butt end of the rocket on the seat, which still had glowing propellant burning. And when this happened, it popped glowing propellant onto the rubber seals of my pressure suit, and you're in 100% oxygen. And when it did, it ignited, and then you're feeding 100% oxygen, and it's like a blowtorch. And fortunately, when this happened, the visor on my pressure suit was busted and fragged, and it cut my eye down, and my eye socket filled with blood, so it didn't hurt my eyeball. The flame, but I got burned pretty bad on my neck and shoulder, and it's very difficult to breathe. And the only thing that I knew, I was stunned from the blow. I knew I had to get the visor up on my pressure suit helmet. There's a button on the right. You push it, and then you raise the visor. It's the way you get your visor up on most pressure suits. I knew I had to get it up, off, get that visor up to shut the oxygen flow from my kit that was in the back of my pressure suit to get all this fire out. And so I did that. When this happened, then I swung a couple times and I hit the ground. When this happened, I couldn't see too much, and I was having trouble breathing because of a lot of smoke and fire. But as it worked out, I was, you know, didn't. The way you look, you either do or you don't, and I don't. Didn't get killed in the flap. So I stood up, and Andy buzzed me. Since I've been talking to him on the way down, it took 4 minutes from the first spin to impact, and they had a helicopter off the ground with a flight surgeon aboard, doctor, at Edwards, and he got out there, well, probably within 5 minutes from the time I landed, and picked me up and gave me a shot of morphine and took me back to hospital. And he worked on me, and, you know, scraping and ultrasonic work on your skin and little skin grafting and stuff like that. But that's part of the deal. Your body is a very forgiving thing.
Did you get the feeling that day that some big aviator in the sky was smiling down on you?
Nope. Waste your time thinking about anything except surviving.
Retired Brigadier General, flying ace, and test pilot Chuck Yeager. He retired from the Air Force in 1975, but kept on consulting as a test pilot right up until the 50th anniversary of his historic flight in the X-1. Yeager has been given many honors in his lifetime, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He lives with his second wife, Victoria, in Penn Valley, California. On February 13th, 2019, he will be 96 years old. Happy birthday, Chuck Yeager, from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes. What It Takes is made possible with the generous funding of the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.